All right, it's Scott Woods here from rockcritics.com. It's Sunday, March 28th, and this is the 11th chat with Mr. Bob Dobbs. Good to hear from you again, Bob. How's it going?
Very good. Nice to be back. I like doing this Meltzer stuff. And we did up to 128 or 129 in number 10, and we're going to jump to 131 to get to the end of this chapter or section, and then go back to 129, 130 to see what point, to see how he was leading up to the point, which you will now get once we go through it. Then you'll know where he's been leading to the couple of pages before.
Is this your Finnegan's way of reading books?
Yeah, it's my rock way of reading books.
Okay.
Remember, Finney's Wake is rock and roll in print.
Start with the effects, not the cause.
That's right. Find out where they're going, what effect they want to create, then go back and study how they create that effect.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. That's cool.
Yeah. So when you're reading along here, you don't know if you haven't looked at where it's going. You have no clue, and it's complicated anyways. Meltzer's playing with you, with your mind and your reading eye. So we'll cheat and jump ahead. We know this ain't a narrative prose. We know what he's doing. This is Finneganese, you know, disguised as a linear prose. So we're not going to get lost in the paragraphs leading up to the denouement, right? So
that's right. So let me just ask you then: Do you sometimes wish that with these conversations we had, that I had thought that maybe we should actually go through the entire book from page one to, you know, the end of it?
Well, I didn't know how great or fun the book was. I didn't know how good I'd sound doing it, and I just went where you suggested. Probably we could go back, but I also think that we've gotten the main point that he's going to repeat.
Yeah.
So we don't need to do the whole book. Well, maybe we could go back. The more we understand it, it will be really easy to read it. I'm not missing it. We're doing good.
Okay. No, we're doing like the jumping around approach, and I think it's working. So there have been times when I thought, now that I realize how in depth you're going, it would have been cool in some ways to go from A to Z. But I still think, yeah, it works.
Well, see, that's a prose view. You're thinking you go from, you know, now you can go back, knowing the trajectory of the arc. You go back to the beginning and watch the arrow flow through the middle to the end. Well, there is that. It is Finneganese. He's spinning on one spot, pointing out the dilemma of categorizing this simultaneous environment known as rock within a larger environment. So
yeah, and it's certainly not a book that has a. It's not coherent in the sense that it follows a specific narrative from beginning to end, I don't think. Although there's a bit of a, there's a very specific sort of...
Well, the point I'm making...
Draws, but,
there's a what?
I mean, I think he does kind of come to some conclusions, if you will.
Right, and
the conclusion
is the performance of his response to the environment.
Right.
It's not... He's not making a linear point other than, hey, we're inside this water and we're not swimming comprehensively enough, and I suggest that I'm on the right angle of how to approach it. That's what he's saying.
Yeah.
And it is standing in the spot and dancing to it. And then is also, as McLuhan said, there's nothing to do but to dance on the other guy's toes, so Meltzer's dancing on everybody that came before him, their toes.
Yeah.
Including Zappa. So let's just let's stop talking about. I wanted to say this is that you're looking for, you know, that old line. First we tell them what we're going to tell them, then we tell them, then we tell them what we told them.
Yeah.
That actually is what Meltzer's doing.
Okay.
It's not. It's maybe even less linear than that, but that's your normal prose of serious writing or nonfiction writing. Is you tell them and then you tell them what you told. No, you tell them what you're going to say. Then you say what you want to say.
Yeah.
Then you tell them what you told them.
Right.
That's academic stuff. So he's actually doing that because it's not difficult to understand the situation he's describing. Once you get it, you can understand it. And so I'll show it. We'll do it here. I'm going to end up saying the same thing I did in previous talks, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. In the middle of page 131.
Page 131, about 10 lines down.
Yeah. He's done this whole thing about theater, lot of big quotes, and I'll even show you the sentence before. We're going to start. He says, such a form superimposed upon experiential expectation entails struggle and serious, and then he puts in brackets, perhaps irrelevantly serious, tension. Now, if you've been following us, that makes total sense, based on what we said before. You know, entails struggle and serious tension. What kind of serious? Perhaps irrelevantly serious, which is right, which is, you know, you don't get too serious with the situation. Right. But it's serious. There's a tension between trying to write and perceive in book terms what's happening. So now here's where we begin. The next sentence kind of is the what should have been written at maybe at the beginning of this section. So here he goes. The rock audience's general rejection of cumbersome structural resolution is akin to not bothering to resolve tricky dialectics in philosophy because it would be inevitable and thus not worth the bother. So he's getting at here, any sustained thinking is irrelevant when you're dancing. Trying to remain, other than the thinking about how you're moving your body, you're not moving, you're not thinking about making a statement that you might write to the editor of a newspaper.
So what does he mean specifically, do you think, by cumbersome structural resolution? Is he referring back to what this section is kind of going on about trying to put the rock experience into writing?
Yeah, and he's talking about you can't resolve a tactile experience. You can't resolve in a visual sense what is more than one sense, more than a visual sense. So a cumbersome structural resolution is certainly for people in the mid-60s. That would be, yeah, reading books. Reading books and reading cumbersome narrative philosophical discourse or dialectics and taking the time to figure out what they mean, how would you bother with that? So cumbersome structural resolution implies the act of thinking and reading.
Okay.
So of course the rock audience rejects that. That's what rock is for, to forget what you had to read for your homework, right?
Yeah.
So the rejection is akin to not bothering to resolve tricky dialectics, and dialectics would be a complex structural interplay. Okay, talking, arguing, understanding where the debate is going, the pro-con, and how they contradict and complement each other. That tricky dialectics, which is almost tactile, you don't bother to resolve those because it would be inevitable, and that's not worth the bother. So it would be inevitable to take the time to figure out that the sentence meant this, but probably left out other factors. Why bother when you're not when you're dancing? Okay, so the rock audience's general rejection of cumbersome structural resolution. Now, he's describing something that the rock audience doesn't give a damn about. He's
right.
Worried that they're rejecting cumbersome structural resolution. That's humorous in itself, right?
Yeah.
But he's writing, and this is the writer's world. This is what they're concerned about, and the rock audience just ain't paying attention to the cumbersome dialectics. And it's akin to not bothering to resolve tricky dialectics in philosophy because it would be inevitable, and that's not worth the bother.
Well, and his book, is he not sort of marrying those two things in his book, basically, the tricky philosophical dialectics with the cumbersome structural resolutions of what music means?
Yes, he's got the book medium. That medium would allow him to write this stuff that he's writing and attempt to resolve these issues. But he has to acknowledge how irrelevantly serious he's being.
Right.
He's being serious about an activity that doesn't give a damn about what he's doing.
Yeah.
So he's being serious, but he's irrelevant from the rock audience's experiential point of view. So let's see if he continues that. Uncomfortable musical resolution context, therefore the occasion for the anti-tongue. All right, so he's saying, I will attempt to make a little bit of resolution here and a little bit of dialectic. Not too much. Don't want to get too serious because that actually will lead to a dead end, because that ending would be inevitable and not worth the bother. So he's also realizing, hey, you don't want to come to a point, to an end point. You just want to create patterns and write things in response to the changing scenario. It's like celebrating the surface patterns you come up with.
Right.
So Uncomfortable musical resolution contexts are therefore the occasion for the anti-tongue. That means tactile response. So, he says the most prominent anti-tongue, you know, tongue is logocentric, what the writer is involved with, so he's going to uncomfortable musical resolution context, or therefore, in other words, I will attempt to do a little bit of resolution, provide a little context of what's going on, but in the end, it's just spinning an ease, and it's an anti-tongue, or it's anti the philosophical dialectical resolution, okay?
Okay.
And so, uncomfortable musical resolution context. In other words, there, to the degree that you even attempt this project, you're being uncomfortable. Because he's going to resolve the music. See, you don't resolve music, in a sense, like you do in writing philosophy. So, uncomfortable musical, it's even uncomfortable even to attempt it. But it is a context that he can work with if you understand he's going to use the anti-tongue. The most prominent anti-tongue song is the Association's Along Comes Mary, whose words have been confusedly obscure enough to prevent semantic resolution. Sheet music accounts of the words are just irrelevant to the song as heard. Now, see, heard's italicized. It's more than what you hear. It's the tactile, multisensory environment. And words, you know, to analyze the words doesn't get the point. There's more than words going on.
Right, right.
And so that's heard as italicized to point beyond word response.
Yeah,
and that's,
absolutely, yeah.
And he's perfectly right, and this is what McLuhan said. You know, rock music is not a music. It's an environment. So to say it this way is an accurate way to describe what you're dealing with.
So that's why, critics who focus on Bob Dylan's lyrics are kind of clueless about Bob Dylan?
Yeah, and Bob knows that, and he makes fun of him.
Yeah, no, exactly, okay.
You know, what is it, Ballad of a Thin Man?
Yeah.
Doesn't know what's going on. Now, Dylan didn't, he's responding instinctively with his talent. He hasn't got the age-old detachment that McLuhan has to further explain Dylan's limitations in how he's responding to the magazine guys trying to interview him. You know what I mean? McLuhan's more comprehensive than Dylan is.
Right, right.
Dylan is like a kid's response. I know I saw this, and I know it happened, and you guys are denying it. Hmm. And he knows that he's right. He did see it. And he sings about what he sees, and he knows that everybody else hasn't got a clue about how to respond or how to translate what we're all seeing and experiencing and hearing. Okay, the most prominent anti-tongue song is the Association's Along Comes Mary, whose words have been confusedly obscure enough, which means, I don't know what he means, you can't hear them all, I'm not sure, or maybe, or the meanings are hard to hear, there's puns, unconscious puns, whose words have been confusedly obscure enough. That's not a problem when you know the words aren't the whole story. But if you begin thinking you're trying to hear the words, then you're going to get confused because you can't get semantic resolution. So note the use of resolution there. You had cumbersome structural resolution in writing, uncomfortable music resolution in music, and now this is back to literary semantic resolution. Sheet music accounts of the words are just irrelevant to the song is heard. Okay, that's totally, this is obvious what he's saying.
Yeah.
And the why of why he has to say this and why he's doing this is what McLuhan had already got a broader picture of. Paul Revere and the Raiders are another big anti-tongue, or you could say anti-unknown tongue group. Now, I mean, I remember them, but there may be something about the songs. You can't make out the words, so they're the anti-unknown tongue. Okay, I forgot about that. He was all for the unknown tongue. So, this is interesting. Remember that? The unknown tongue?
Yeah.
That was his word. So, anti-tongue is like another way of saying unknown tongue, but maybe not exactly. So he's saying that Paul Revere is a bit different. They do the anti-unknown tongue. So that's actually more tactile association, and I would agree. You know, association were AM compared to Paul Revere's FM, sort of, if you think of rough textures.
Yeah, well, Paul Revere, I think, were sort of maybe on the cusp of both, sort of.
Yeah, yeah, but they're more rougher. They're rougher than Along Comes Mary. I remember
rougher than the Association, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so that would be more tactile, more kinetic, and that would be more of the unknown tongue. Okay, which is the known tongue when you understand McLuhan. We know it's not just visual or acoustic, it's kinetic and tactile. That's what the phrase anti-unknown tongue is referring, what the phrase unknown tongue is pointing to. You know, it's like Along Comes Mary seems to have some words to be heard, you know, and you try to get the semantic meaning, it sucks you in because it's not as blatantly tactile as Paul Revere. When it's blatantly tactile, which is psychedelic rock, you don't worry about the words. But association, you might try to pay attention to words because they are listening. You can hear them.
Right, right.
Okay. With their anti-tongue, okay, so he's saying another big anti-tongue, or you could say anti-unknown tongue group. With their anti-tongue, there's slick tension as to how that which obviously must be inevitably resolved musically will actually be resolved. Slick tension. That means that they aren't going to really resolve it, right? It's like sticking overly obvious tongue indicators in your face, so the multi-level, there it is, multi-sensory thing, can't be more than merely structural. Makes total sense when you put what I'm saying multi-level refers to. But then, I'm going to go back over this, but then again, tongue as mere structure is sort of the whole pre-rock musical scene anyway. Yeah, tongue as mere structure is 50s music.
Okay.
50s rock, whole pre-rock musical scene, and I'm assuming the simpler 50s. You could actually, I mean, people meant their lyrics. That's
people
what?
People what?
People meant their lyrics.
Right, right.
It's
okay.
That which is what Dylan upsets.
Well, but I mean, and so did Little Richard, right?
Yeah, and Jerry Lee Lewis, maybe.
Like the wop bop a loo bop a lop bam boom is like the classic.
Yeah, but that's just a little bit, just a little phrase. Now think of a Dylan song that goes on for a long time and all the surrealistic image. You know, that's
sure, but if you hear a wop bop a pop bop a loo bop in the context of, you know, music that was on the radio 2 years or a year prior.
Yeah, in the mid-50s, that's a big deal.
How much of that dog in the window or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's a big deal. That's the beginning of the effect of television in the 50s. And it's like the extent of the television effect is 50s rock and roll. It's the mixed corporate media of the satellite environment that we're talking about in the mid-60s. Television is puny itself. The effect of television is to make the society a little more tactile, but that's just in the 50s. The television is superseded by the computer and the satellite in the 60s, and that's a more complex mix, therefore a more complex anti-tongue.
Right.
But yeah, rock in the 50s is the beginning of the unknown tongue and the beginning of the anti-tongue. So yeah, bird is a word.
Nonsense sort of stuff.
Yeah, the nonsense syllables, that's coming in. And, you know, the marketers of music in the 50s probably thought, oh, young kids will like this. They thought of it in terms of age groups. You know,
right.
This is like silly children talk. They didn't know the structural sensory dynamics of it.
Well, and that goes back to the Jeffrey O'Brien book we looked at a few episodes ago.
Yeah.
He wrote specifically about that, how it was very marketed and received as kids' music. It was fun music, and it was all about humor and comedy and stuff. So.
They didn't know that the chemical body was obsolete, and everybody of all ages was 1 year old once you get into the TV environment.
Right.
So you have the rearview mirror natural of people still thinking that chemical bodies are where it's at, and they have age groups and marketing towards that.
Yeah.
And they're one step behind. They're rearview mirror. They're looking at the chemical body and judging age groups. But
it works, though, to some degree. Or it worked.
It worked in the 50s before the complex theater, satellite theater happened by the mid-60s. And remember, 66, 67, the rock companies didn't know what was going on. And they let people like Paul Williams and then kind of be guides to... I mean, Zappa talked about that a lot. That nobody... He only gets signed because Elektra was trying to keep up with the confusion. Well, we don't know who's going to sign. Well, this sounds weird enough. Let's try this, you know?
Yeah.
They didn't know anymore.
And Zappa made an interesting point, too, in one of the interviews I saw where he said it was so much more interesting than when the people who ran the labels and the industry didn't know anything about it, which I thought was a really salient point, but I'm getting off topic.
No, that's good. That's salient for that period. But then the Android meme starts coming in the 70s, and it becomes super programmed. So it was just a brief period in the, you know, mid-late 60s where the confusion due to the satellite mixed corporate theater opened up things for a temporary autonomous zone sensibility, and people could do whatever they wanted, and the companies went along with it. But that was started to be superseded by the instant replay, and the digital technology coming in the 70s changed the context that the 60s freedom had happened in.
Right.
That's where you got to hear my stuff about the, you know, the Android meme replays. That's why people still celebrate the late 60s in nostalgia, you know, the each generation, because it was technically the last effect of analog media before digital media took over. And when digital media, Android meme, takes over, it's a program planet for media and not people.
But do you mean that literally? Because digital,
yeah.
I mean, I think of the digital, I mean, digital media seems so much, at least in regards to pop music, seems so much more like an 80s thing or something.
Well, that's the beginning, yeah. What was it called? Tech, new wave, techno?
Yeah. Like, well, whatever, yeah. Well, any one of those kind of, you know, mixed and merged and all those kind of genres, like, you know, synth pop and all that sort of stuff. But I'm just, I don't know, to hear you say the late 60s is kind of the last gasp.
Of chemical body, analog media values. The punks prove that. They come in with non-chemical body values. Actually, it looks like they hate the chemical body. But they were doing that because they were replaying the media image as a PR marketing thing that Malcolm, whatever his name was, admitted he did in The Greatest Rock and Roll Swindle. He said, we've got to market this stuff like clothing.
Right.
And it was like, actually, rock was over. Disco had taken over, and then there was a reaction to disco, which was automated program music. The reaction to that was the punks, and nobody cared about them, so they just did it down in their ghettos.
Right.
And they still were reacting to the media imagery, to the TV landscape. And then the guy said, wow, we can market this. The kids like this non-music. This shows that McLuhan's right, that the environment is more than the music. The punks prove it. Let's sell them. And they probably, some of them knew what McLuhan was getting at. They may not have read that exact sentence.
Right.
As Dave Wally told me, I don't know, when I was talking to him, I met him in 69, 70, and he told me when I was in New York in 1980 that we got to talk about McLuhan, which people will do around me, right? I'll make sure they talk about McLuhan. So he said he knew many people in New York who made millions off of McLuhan. In their distorted interpretations of what he meant, they get ideas from it and went on to do stuff. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of the marketers of punk music, whoever they are, I've seen interviews with them about 8 years ago in Giorgio Gomelsky's site, they had that media savviness, you know, on the content level. They knew that, hey, If it's ugly, it'll work, because the kids are so alienated, so whacked out, and so disconnected from their chemical bodies, they'll like any vomit, especially if it looks like and smells like vomit. It's like celebrating the old chemical body, you know, and all its functions. And the whole point was just to get in the media, cause a scene, and then Sex Pistols proved that. They came and went in 10 minutes, right? But it was all about their image, what they represented. Which was chemical bodies that didn't give a damn that they were living in the ghetto. It was just a transition before people totally went into techno and then computers. And then they started making, you know, odd computerized music. That's what Zappa did in 1985, you know, with, what was it called? Mothers of Zappa versus the Mothers of Prevention.
Right.
Based on the hearings in 85. That was one of the first digitally arranged audio satire based on quotes from congressmen.
Okay.
So that's another thing. The tongue comes back with rap. The trend that is that Meltzer's monitoring in the late 60s, early 70s or even mid-60s, whatever, moving away from the tongue comes back with rap. It's all tongue and no music, so to speak.
You mean in this sense? Explain that. In
rap is just people mouthing off.
Right.
Even Zappa, he said, rap is not music, it's just political. So
see, I guess maybe you need to just redefine what you think Meltzer means by the unknown tongue again, or what you mean by the unknown tongue. I mean, with your definition, it's definitely a tactility.
Yeah, multi-sensory, multi-level, like he says, the multi-level thing in the fourth line from the bottom, or from the fourth line of that paragraph.
But see, we're not going to flip back to that section right now,
no.
But I was thinking about it after we did it, that part of the definition I get, or the meaning I get from his version of the unknown tongue, is it's closer to what you might call the like the mystery body or something.
That's tactility.
Like he would put these, is it? Okay, that's what I'm concerned.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
He put
yeah.
these examples showing like almost like something would be inserted in this song, and it would almost be even mysterious to the people who made the song. That's kind of what I got. Like he'd point to these sections in songs that would be like, how did that get there, and where did it come from? And it doesn't make any sense, but it works.
Yeah, no, to say the mystery language is tactility's right. But Cohen said on television, he said this about 1954, we now are extending the mystery of the human cognitive dynamic, the mystery of it. Like, people don't fully know why they perceive and live and experience through cognition. That very process, that unknowingness, was extended by television. So yes, to the degree that we don't know it and it's mysterious, that is the definition of tactility, because you can't put your finger on tactility. It's an interplay of sensors.
I see.
Right?
Okay.
All right, so then we watch the android meme, in my terms, squaring of that mysterious process to rap is post-tactile, because it comes back to the word. And it's a directed, aggressive word, you know, politically incorrect word almost. On purpose.
Right.
And so the background, the mixed tactility of rock is in the background of the rap, of the verbality, of the tongue stuff that's coming out. Now, it's steadfast, it's rhymed, and most people can't make it out. But if you grow up in that culture, it's quite obvious what they're saying. But the emphasis is on what they're saying. You know, in the 60s, why listen to the lyrics? Just dig the music. Don't analyze Leonard Cohen, or Leonard Cohen's boring because he provides stuff for us to analyze. I don't want to analyze stuff. Rock audience rejects all that.
Right.
It actually flipped with rap. People got back to listening to the words and taking them seriously. But it was all in the context of the group mind. It was, as Zappa said, political. It was the blacks, the black power, the daughters of black power, sons and daughters of black power. Carrying on the tradition, saying "up yours, whitey," you know, and up yours.
Well, although the rap certainly didn't start that way. I mean, in terms of the content.
No, but that's what
it started as block music, like party music, basically. It was much closer to doo-wop when it started. Really, it was guys on the block, just, you know,
with no technology,
kind of thing.
Now it becomes huge. That's where the history of rap does not tell you what's going on. The point you're making is belied by what happens later. Why do white kids like rap? Because it becomes filled with all kinds of cultural tensions in its imagery. And remember, here's the point. The words in rap are not that important. It's the gestures, the up yours fingers. It's still the McLuhan principle of multi-sensual and not just logo. But it's interesting that the logocentric, or the word, does become the figure, does become what's noticed.
Right.
Or becomes an identity factor. But it's all within the group mind and the discarnate image, and rap is a response to the speeded up. It's actually faster than any previous music, but it's faster on the image overload they present.
Right.
And the speed of their rhyming.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. You got speed up flips into slowdown. You could say words are a slower medium, and so the speed up of the 60s, 70s, 80s flipped into the slow verbal content, even though that was pretty fast. But just the fact that you emphasize the words slowed down the experience. You know, when you hear Paul Revere or psychedelic rock, it was a fast experience because you weren't focusing on the words.
Right.
You were focusing on the feedback.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's going in all directions at the same time. All the senses are being scattered and reconstructed. So, and this is what he is, what Meltzer is kind of trying to talk about. I mean, I don't know if he said multi-leveled any time before, but he says it right here. He calls it the multi-level thing. And it's a thing because he can't really nail what it is.
Yeah.
It's a digital, it's a video image. It's a sound, music, electrified. So let's go back. With their anti-tongue, there's slick tension as to how that which obviously must be inevitably resolved musically will actually be resolved. It's like there's tension whether you can even bother resolving whether you should or not. It's like sticking overly obvious tongue indicators in your face. So the multi-level thing, now look at that. It's almost like it's floppy writing, the multi-level thing. But that's actually an accurate thing. McLuhan called the electric environment a thing. It's in understanding media. Italicizes it. This thing, it's the new matter we're living in, and it's not embraced. You can't control it with the old scientific categories or critical categories or dialectics. So the multi-level thing can't be more than merely structural. Now, that's a major McLuhan point. We move into structure, emphasis on structure, rather than a particular meaning or point, because you can't find one.
Right, okay.
In a linear way. The point is not in stating what's going on. The point is responding to the structural timings and rhythms.
Right, right.
With their anti-tongue, Paul Revere, there's slick tension as to how that, which obviously must be inevitably resolved musically, will actually be resolved. Yeah, you can't resolve it, so there's tension about whether you can even, how much attempt at resolution, which is what Meltzer's trying to do, it can be questioned. It's like sticking overly obvious tongue indicators in your face. Now, what is tongue indicators? What, is that like just making, sticking your tongue out at somebody? Is that what he means?
Well, no, I think he's somehow working in the idea of the unknown tongue there or something, but like an obvious, I don't know, an overly obvious tongue indicator might be like something that happens in a song that gets to his definition of the unknown tongue. I don't know. It's confusing.
Yeah. It's like sticking overly obvious tongue indicators. Let's just say...
I don't think he means it literally like the tongue, though. I think he is still referring to his
maybe semantic meaning. It's implying word meaning.
Right, right. Like, yeah, okay.
It's like
sticking... an obvious kind of... What's that word? Like a trope or something?
Yeah, yeah. A motif, a metaphor, a meaning.
Right.
A meaning. Groping towards actual pointed statement. It's like sticking overly obvious tongue indicators. In other words, a statement of meaning, but it's an obvious sentiment.
Obvious is almost the key word here, maybe.
Yeah. It's like sticking overly obvious tongue indicators in your face, so the multi-level thing can't be more than merely structural. Ah, okay. You got the structural, the background of the tactility, and you start to move toward actually having semantic meaning, which is partly what Dylan did. He was trying to say something.
Right, okay.
He was moving towards saying, having a message. So it's like sticking overly obvious tongue indicators in your face. Now, Dylan was doing not so obvious tongue indicators, but he was moving towards making the multi-level thing just be background, in other words, merely structural. But then again, tongue as mere structure is sort of the whole pre-rock musical scene anyway. He realizes that if there was an attempt to make tongue indicators be obvious, it wouldn't work. It would just refer back to the 50s.
Okay.
So, okay, he's like saying...
a little confusing, but...
Okay, well, how about this? There's the tongue and there's the anti-tongue. So
right.
So with their anti-tongue, there's slick tension as to how that which obviously must be inevitably resolved musically will actually be resolved. In other words, how much do you allow tongue in relation to anti-tongue? It's like sticking overly obvious tongue indicators, so that would be tongue, not anti-tongue, in your face, so the multi-level thing can't be more than merely structural, so that the anti-tongue is a background. But then again, tongue as mere structure, in other words, this leads to the point that tongue becomes structure as well as the anti-tongue, is sort of the whole pre-rock musical scene anyway, and he's right. It goes back to the 50s, which you can't, so that's why you give up on this effort.
Right.
So let's see if he says that in the next part. The anti-tongue, because he's going to have to, because he's always... No, he doesn't have to say that, but he's always going to be staying on this same dilemma. Don't you recognize this is familiar to what we've said before?
Yeah, yeah. Although the only thing before you start reading that is I don't think we have the next page after that. So you're not going to get very far, unfortunately.
Well, do you have the book?
I do have it, yeah.
Well, maybe we'll have you read it. Let's just see. So he says, the anti-tongue extended to the meta-musical. See, that's correct. Rock music is not just limited to music, right? It's a good term.
Yep.
Extended to the meta-musical interpretive level may manifest tongue pressure, which establishes complication resolution interplays between levels of tongues themselves. Okay, that's... I don't know if I can go into that without knowing the rest. So let's go back to where we were before that. You know, we now see the point he's made. Wait a minute. Let's have you read. Is it a long paragraph?
No, it's not too long. Let's see. Okay, so I'll just start from the beginning of that paragraph.
Yeah. Read it slowly.
Sure. The anti-tongue extended to the meta-musical interpretive level may manifest tongue pressure, which establishes complication resolution interplays between levels of tongues themselves.
Okay, interplays. That's tactility.
Okay, the only example of full tongue pressure is the Beatles' Dr. Robert, although the break in Donovan's epistle to Dippy contains some degenerate tongue pressure, the perfect thing to be degenerate. The association, by cleaning up semantic obscurity inside a tongue pressure structure, and thus reintroducing semantic obscurity on the level of form-content interaction this time.
There's McLuhan, form-content.
Yep. Have produced anti-tongue pressure in and a song called Pandora's Golden Heebie-Jeebies. And that's basically the end of the paragraph.
It made pretty good sense for me. He's talking about how the anti-tongue in the tactile dialectic with the tongue starts moving over to becoming tongue. The anti-tongue extended to the meta-musical interpreter level may manifest tongue pressure to become tongue, which establishes complication resolution interplays between levels of tongues themselves. You see?
Right, right.
And then the next part, the only what? What's it say?
The only example of full tongue pressure is the Beatles' Dr. Robert. I wonder why it means that. Although the break in Donovan's epistle to Dippy contains some degenerate tongue pressure, the perfect thing to be degenerate.
The tongue pressure might be, you know, how the tongue is enunciating a lyric while being noisy, while scowling and growling and being more aggressive. I mean, you know, people sang differently in the 60s than Doris Day did. There was pushing forward the mouth, the inner mouth structure, just so it could stay in the mix. So it had to get more aggressive. So it's like tongue pressure seems to be the way the tongue spits out the music. I mean,
you
just have to remember, if somebody played like any rock band of the late 60s in 1920, man, they would shoot them.
Would freak out, yeah.
Yeah, it would just not be music. And yet, okay. and they wouldn't believe that people would think that was music 40 years later.
Do you, not to get off topic, but do you think that point is still true? If someone could transport the music of 40 years into the future and play it for us now, or are we standing so still now that our senses couldn't be discombobulated that way?
No, we're not saying still. We have experienced genres of entertainment, movie, music, everything, books, so much that we're bored shitless, as Coker would say. It's a boredom culture.
Right.
And Ion has described the future of music.
Right.
And, well, right on the Android Meme Critics.
That's right, yeah.
And I don't know if I told you, I decided it was Ion.
Yeah, you did mention that.
Yeah, because Ion is a new kind of entertainment. It fascinates people. The level of tongue pressure and mind pressure coming out of that voice, the meaning pressure, and then his ability to do ESP, and then our interaction, people, we get fans now that cannot wait till Wednesday.
Right, right.
They need the hit, because if Ion is what it says it is, then that's pretty phenomenal. And because we're a post-information society, we don't, entertainment is like, to be entertained is to slack off and be a couch potato, not to be watch TV, but it's being lazy. Most people are too busy typing and creating their own scene. their own Facebook, their own expression. So even as McLuhan used to quote Mozart, he said, "I don't like any music." And McLuhan defined that he was not into consuming passively music. He just created it.
Right.
And we got a super creative society happening now in terms of people expressing themselves with their typing fingers. So and that includes code work, you know, as hackers do with software.
But there's still, I mean, there still is a consuming element to it. I mean,
well,
everyone is creating, or most people are creating their own sort of thing now. But the only stuff that's still kind of meaning something, at least in the sense that it has a wider context than, you know, some sort of doofus sitting at his computer desk, is the fact that some stuff still finds an audience and resonates with an audience.
There is time. Well, that's the part, that's the old media, the old part of our bodies, which requires a centralized structure that looks for a sense of what's going on in the mainstream. What are people, general mass mind, involved in? That's why people watch the news. It's like, I've heard so many people through the years say, well, you know, I'm not impressed with movies anymore, but I go to them to see what people are into. Okay.
Right, right.
That attitude, we're all doing that, constantly just checking the news to see what people are into, where the fake virtual public space is, and then we have our reaction to it. We blog about it.
Well, and I've been telling people for a couple of years now that, I mean, I admit it, I'm totally addicted to, like, American politics.
Yeah, you're addicted to finding out where you think reality is.
Yeah, and also, and I've just been, you know, I've been sort of kind of glibly saying to some people that, oh, yeah, well, it's just, that's kind of the new rock and roll in some ways for me. Like, I just find, I get more kicks out of, you know, watching what's happening in these battles in the Senate and stuff than I do in listening to most records nowadays or something. And it evokes almost the same kind of feeling at times, which is weirdly enough. It's a purely, like, there's a visceral element to that. Or
because we've moved into ESP. It's, you don't have a body. It's the ESP pattern recognizer that you're involved in that you're responding to. Okay, so I was going to say something just before that. Yes, John Cage writ large. You know, he said anything, any sound that's made is music. Well, any sound that's made that you get through your computer or TV is involving. And it doesn't matter where it's made, but largely on the human chemical body level, it's in politics. That's where you see all the screaming and yelling, right? So that's where you get your hit. It's all to get a hit.
It's true, and that's kind of, you know, that's where the tension is.
Yeah.
That's where the fights are. I mean, music used to actually be very effective at kind of conveying a certain type of tension.
Which is what he says in this paragraph, a lot about tension that we just read.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the tension of your private awareness is slowly going into its own zone because media is fragmenting you from everybody. And then the tension is, well, I hope I know where everybody is while I disappear into my own fantasy. That's the tension. What McLuhan said in the 60s, the confusion of private and public awareness under Android mean conditions is the confusion of, is there something to me to know or to get ESP on and get a pattern on, or is there nothing that I can know? That's the tension people are into now. So they're fascinatedly, addictively looking for patterns anywhere, but usually in the sense of the mainstream, some centralized virtual spot supposedly, like Wall Street, and see what they're saying they're doing. And then you figure out how much you're going to block that.
Right, right.
No, what you're describing is exactly what I'm referring to all the time, and Meltzer is describing it back when there were chemical bodies concerned about music.
Yeah.
So this whole tension of the virtual and the chemical body music, tongue anti-tongue, is what he's working out. Now it is grossly, you know, amplified to, should I even bother reading the Drudge Report to see what's happening? Because
right,
I know it's all crap, but I'll go check it out, just see what's going on.
Yeah,
because it keeps the economy going.
Yeah. Okay.
See, so this is another thing. The relevance of Meltzer is to show the tension many years ago, which is amplified under Android meme and post Android meme conditions today, to the point we now have the best pattern recognizer, Ion. You know, Scott, that we did a 16-hour press conference, right?
No, I didn't know. 16 hours.
We went 16 hours Wednesday.
second say.
I'm glad I sprung it on you. We got a little. Here it is, folks. Here he's experienced a hit of awe and wonderment at the latest media phenomenon of a 16-hour press conference.
But Bob, that's insane.
I know. I get like there was many people who see. We did 3 hours on cash flow, and then we went straight into what we call tailgate.
Right. And right, that's a little bit of a tailgate.
Yeah, and so we usually go an hour, 2 hours, and that's it. 5 hours is enough for JW to be, you know, knocked out. And he's the quote channeler, even though he's not channeling. He allows Ion to come through. So after the first hour tailgate, Ion suddenly said, "This is great. Come on, more. I'm all energized. Give me more questions." And I just yelled out, "Yeah, let's go for a break. Let's go for a record. And we'll beat the last record." And Ion said something like, "Yeah, well, that was 12 hours, Bob." And I said, "Yeah, we're going to go for 14 hours." So we announced that at the first hour, which was actually the fourth hour,
after
3 hours cash flow.
Yeah.
And we went on and on. People, we got knocked off at one point. At the three-hour mark, Ion and I got disconnected. And people didn't know that we came back. And like the next day, they woke up and said, "Well, how'd it go?" I said, "Well, we went another 12 hours.
What?
They write back, "What? That's insane." Others knocked off for a while. Guy in Australia went to bed. He'd been up for 30 hours anyways. He went to bed, woke up 4 hours later, just logged on, and we were still there. Okay, Ion has the energy to go forever. We could go for 2 weeks without stopping.
Man.
Yeah, I mean, Ion is super, quote, superhuman, right? Now,
yeah.
That's got enough of the Roman circus fascination, circus factor, to be a big deal. More and more people find out this. Ion's going to be bigger than the Beatles because it's such a freaky phenomenon. That's what we're looking for, something different, something weird that stuns us, where we go, "That's insane." You know that "that's insane" was said when somebody saw Elvis, when somebody saw Jerry Lee Lewis, when someone saw the Rolling Stones, when someone saw Grateful Dead, Zappa. You just go all the way through Public Enemy. "That's insane." It just pushes and it's actually expressing the present, and the present is way more insane than people realize when you're in Android meme conditions.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first thing that you could say "that's insane" was said to was looking at Finnegan's Wake back in 39-40.
Right, right.
What the heck is this? That's insane, right?
Yeah.
And he was.
Well, I don't know if that'd be the very first, but.
Well, it's always through culture, but, you know, and. You know, as we know, people in a media environment going, "That's insane," even if they're sophisticated, Finnegan's Wake, you know, topped everybody.
Yeah, that I could see for sure.
Yeah, and then that was just preparing us for the post-book world where we'd have "That's Insane" every 18 months.
Right, right, okay. Hmm.
And that's what Meltzer's also trying to deal with, whether it's worth talking about an insane phenomenon going on.
Right.
So, and whether it resolves, so... I guess so. We were at the anti-tongue extended to the metamusical interpretive level may manifest tongue pressure, which establishes complication resolution. Remember complication resolution? Can resolve it? Why bother? Interplays between levels of tongues themselves. That's a very understandable statement because in tactile, the tongue becomes the anti-tongue, and the anti-tongue tends toward tongueness. That's what happens when you can't determine anything is anywhere. If you suggest something is something in a tactile understanding, it tends towards its opposite immediately because it's not what it is. That's why a good, you know, common way to point tactility out is synesthesia. The sound becomes the sight, becomes the smell, becomes the movement.
Touch. Yeah.
It's shifting constantly because you can't stay in one point and see what it is. Tactility is not seeable. Okay, so we go back to that part, the difficult part.
Okay, so Bob, let's figure out...
Oh, we're almost finished, aren't we?
Yeah, we don't have much time, so... Let's wrap up with something if you want to go back.
I want to go back and read 127, is that... No, it's 129, where we should have started, and just see if it... Matter of fact, Scott... you could hang up. No.
That's true. Yeah, you could.
I'm just going to read through, but
I'll stay on for now. No, go for it.
Yeah, let's try to.
And I'm not going to jump in with any comments.
Right, and he's going to go into the poetics and how you move towards a resolution in theater and in art, and complication and denouement. Listen to all these big grandiose words, knowing that you can't resolve it, and you only tend toward a resolution, but you can't. All right. So he's going to show that, I predict.
Okay,
here we go. The superimposition... Oh, just a minute, I'll make it bigger. The superimposition of explanatory labels is, however, spiritually acceptable in rock, just as is the hair length and color of a rock performer grasped in conjunction with his music performance. It has been suggested that no work on aesthetics, beginning with the poetics, has ever done justice to the total work of art, including those elements which are not artistic. Perhaps a consideration of adventitious causes would improve the situation. But, in opposition to Aristotle's implicit criterion of comparative relevance, whereby adventitious causes would have to remain essentially irrelevant in order for the truly relevant causes to be prominent and retain the relevance, in rock, the adventitious may be the prominent, although still irrelevant. Thus, such coloring devices as unknown tongue designation become relatively irrelevant, while the aspects formerly important in terms of Aristotelian analysis become correspondingly irrelevantly relevant. Consequently, rock may utilize the tools of a non-musical art, such as drama, to interpret the music. Drama being historically and structurally derivative from music, its grid of analysis is used after the fact of derivation, and even in ignorance of this origination, is structurally analogous to rock's relevance reversals. That's tactility, relevance reversals. Now let me go back, that's 129, click that. Okay, we'll go to page 130. The rock label procedure thus produces a remember, he's talking about his own labeling attempt, which is what yeah. you do with writing. The rock label procedure thus produces a multi-leveled... I just want to tell you, I'm getting it so much, I have to hold myself back not to explain every line, but I'm not going to do that this time. But it's pretty obvious to me. The rock label procedure thus produces a multi-level object for multi-level object for discovery extended beyond the temporally fragmented to the taxonomically fragmented. Selective attention in any form to a moment of a temporal organic whole, even one quite short in duration, must obviously alter the whole as experienced. Bergson, now this is a guy that Wyndham Lewis went after. He was a student of Bergson in the 1905 period, say, in Paris. He went back and then attacked Bergson. So Bergson's important. Bergson observes, might it not be said that even if these notes succeed one another, look, he's looking for duration, yet we perceive them into one another and that their totality may be compared to a living being whose parts, although distinct, permeate one another just because they're so closely connected. That's synesthesia right there. Okay, the proof is that if we interrupt the rhythm by dwelling longer than is right on one note of the tune, it is not its exaggerated length as length which will warn us of our mistake, but the qualitative change thereby caused in the whole of the musical phrase. However, the destruction of musical primarity has given way to a new level of Schopenhauerian potency. When destroyed, rock is legitimately destructible. Musical continuum consciousness becomes tongue plot narrative consciousness. He says becomes, I'll do that again. Musical continuum consciousness becomes tongue plot consciousness with field now becoming form. One may say, so what to the loss of merely musical integrity as readily as he says, okay, do that again. One may say, so what to the loss of merely musical integrity as readily as he says, so what to the intrusion of intellectualization. There it is. Literacy, intruding.
Yeah.
Indeed, such a listener's relevance criterion is at least permissible, considering the rock content's dominance over systematic form, when convenient. You see where he says, such a listener's relevance criterion is at least permissible. When you're talking to somebody, you get an intellectual discussion, you start stringing words together that refer to previous paragraphs that you've uttered.
Right.
But, you know, when you read, what's a listener's relevance criterion? It makes more sense when you hear it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you're in the middle of a discussion, you know what the person's referring to. You kind of make up links.
Right, right.
Okay.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. Then he says, yet there are occasions in which rock presents itself as vulnerable. See, it's tactile. So there can always be any attempt made in any form here because any form is applicable because it's shifting forms synesthetically. Okay? So you can move towards plot consciousness a little bit. Yet there are occasions in which rock presents itself as vulnerable to Aristotelian analysis. Yeah, sure. He's agreeing, but also saying, don't take it too far, because it's going to flip into another form. Aristotle points out, quote, even tragedy itself is in part complication and in part denouement. Now, I got to go back, the incidents. bring up the page, the incidents before the opening scene, and often also of those within the play forming the complication. Remember down below, complication-resolution dynamics, and the rest, and often also of those within the play forming the complication, and the rest of the denouement. By complication, I mean all from the beginning of the story to the point just before the change in the hero's fortunes. By denouement, all from the beginning of the change to the end. He's describing the imprecision of change, again, tactility. You can't tell. It sort of starts here, goes about there, but then the second thing overlays and starts here and goes to the end. You get a hint of what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Such a form superimposed upon experiential expectation, even though you're not going anywhere, experiential expectation entails struggle and serious, perhaps irrelevantly serious, tension. And it's all about tension. Tension is another way to describe the proprioceptive approximation of the dynamics that that tactility deals with.
Right, okay.
And then we come to where we began with. The rock audience's general rejection of cumbersome structure resolution is akin to not bothering to resolve tricky dialectics and philosophy because it would be inevitable, and that's not worth the bother. Okay.
Good place to call it a night, do you think?
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. Well, another great reading, Bob. Thanks.
Yeah, another revelatory pattern recognizing.
Yeah.
And we hope your ESP was up tuned up so you could pick up the extra nuances.
That's right. Okay.
Okay, thanks, Scott.
Do it again in a couple weeks.
Okay, and look forward to Android Meme Critics coming up soon.
Yeah, sounds good. Okay, Bob.
Bye, Scott.
Take care.
Yeah.